More money is flowing into Jaxport's big deepening project, but big cuts could be on the way at FSCJ. And drama in a local political battle, some of the stories making headlines this week. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9 and never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime or stream us live on Facebook. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, it's a rallying cry to bring back Book Fair to local schools. We'll tell you about it. Plus, don't miss it as performer Tom Shedd talks about the incredible legacy of the Florida Folk Festival happening this Memorial Day weekend. All of that and more ahead. But first, it's Friday and time for the most rocking news segment of the week, our media roundtable, as we welcome a cast of all-stars. Florida Times Union columnist Mark Woods is here. Hey, Mark.
Good morning.
A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Hello.
David Cotton, who writes for the Daily Record.
Good morning.
And Charles Griggs, contributing writer with the Jacksonville Free Press.
Good morning, Melissa.
Guys, it is so good to see you and so much to discuss this Friday as we head into the holiday weekend. Everything from big census growth to in Jacksonville to high drama in a local council presidency race and more. But our top story this Friday: the Jacksonville Port Authority has taken a major step forward in its quest to deepen the shipping channel in the St. Johns River to accommodate the bigger cargo ships that are expected to soon start flowing through the widened Panama Canal. Now, the federal government has just committed $17.5 million in the upcoming fiscal year to help with this project at Jaxport. Congressman John Rutherford says the deepening will bring more jobs to the area. Here's Rutherford.
Jaxport is already the largest container port in the state of Florida. We really need to grow it so that we can compete against ports like Savannah and others. But trust me, this is not a zero-sum game situation that we're talking about. There's plenty of growth out there for each of the ports.
Still unanswered, though, is what the total price tag will be for the Jaxport project, where the rest of the money will come from, and continuing concerns from environmental groups about the impact to the river. What do you think about this? Give us a call and let us know your thoughts on deepening the St. Johns River at Jaxport, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or weigh in on our Facebook page where we are streaming this show live right now. Mark Woods of the Times Union, let's begin with you. This is just a fraction of the $700 million or more they're expecting this to cost, but still, Jaxport can claim a win now. They're getting money from the feds.
Right. Yeah, this is the start. So that, I think they refer to it as the new start hurdle. That's why it's a big deal that it moves the needle in that direction. But yes, I mean, it's $17.5 million, and then I think it was another $15 million from the state or something, but that's still, if I'm doing my math, less than 5% of what the cost would be if it met the projected cost, which has never happened, I don't think, in the history of port dredging. It's always been double, sometimes triple. I mean, this is a projected to be close to $700 million, and it's, if history tells us anything, it'll be $1 billion. So where does, when you think of it in those terms, $17.5 million, is it not, it's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. David Cotton, what about the congressman's argument that Jaxport needs to do this because there will be enough shipping traffic for Jaxport to be competitive with Savannah and other East Coast ports? Not everyone agrees with that, but certainly the local business and political elite are all singing from the same page on that argument.
Well, and to that point, Jacksonville is also not the only city on the East Coast that is saying, we either want to do the same thing with our port, or we want to do, other expansions to their ports. So there's a lot of competition among ports along the East Coast. I think also, as Mark said, this is just a small piece of the pie here. I mean, this is a project that would take the better part of a decade to complete, and whether or not the federal government is going to continue to prioritize it, that's another question as well.
So Jacksonville is knee-deep in competition with other ports. And what's happened is that this allows them to, you know, sort of the horses out of the barn now. So you're really going to have to continue progress on this project in order to be competitive. And that's the big picture here, because there's so many competitors out there, especially in Savannah, where they have really taken leaps forward in trying to stay competitive in the shipping port market. This is almost a no-brainer for people who are trying to remain competitive, especially those folks in the port industry. But that doesn't go without the criticism of what are you going to do environmentally in order to mitigate some of the issues there.
Yeah, the two big arguments against it, AG, have been the environmental impact and the hundreds of millions of dollars of investment. Can Jack's Port demonstrate that they would recoup that for the community at large with a lot of increased traffic and the job projections that they've put forth?
Yeah, I mean, you can come up with projections to justify anything, including this port project. But here's the reality. Charleston, Norfolk, Savannah, they're all 50 feet and deeper, or they're getting there. Norfolk's going to be 55 feet deep. You know, we're fighting over going to 47. So the bigger ships, which are theoretically the target here, are, you know, going to go to other places. And that's a reality. You know, never mind the amount of time it takes to actually do the project, never mind the environmental concerns and so on. These are all concerns. And if you look at the federal government, Rick Scott did some heavy lobbying to get this done. But, you know, money went to every port on the Eastern Seaboard. So you're seeing, you know, the competition just being goosed along by the federal government with state money and whatever local money comes out of it. But there are more questions than answers, and 17.5 doesn't resolve anything.
Well, from a logistics standpoint, Jacksonville really stands in a good position to be very competitive, because if you're talking about ships that are coming from the Pacific and from the West that are cutting across the canal, Jacksonville's the first really point that heads west for distribution points. So we can be competitive. It's just that we'll have to be smart and stay in the game with this. From an investment standpoint, the money will continue to have to be raised. And since they've already started the process, there's probably going to be no end in sight. The money over that period of time, we're going to have to continue to invest in doing something like this.
Mark Woods.
And you mentioned it before, from an environmental standpoint, the mitigation is just woefully inadequate. I mean, it assumes a very minimal effect on the river and the environment around it. And again, historically, as a nation, we've underestimated the damage done in projects like this. You look around Florida, Everglades are the biggest one, and the cost that comes later. I hope that is accurate, but I fear it's not. And if it's not, it feels almost like a river version of the pension reform, where get something now, but let our kids worry about it later. You know?
All right, let's go to your calls as we discuss the Jack's Port deepening project and the other top stories of the week. Right now, with our Friday Media Roundtable, it's 549-2937. Eric is on the west side. Hey, Eric, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. A lot is being made in the conversation of the competitive nature of the deepening of the port, and there is some truth to that aspect. However, it's, in my mind, much more a cooperative venture on the part of the East Coast ports and the federal government. When you look at the cost of the deepening of the channel versus the cost of the landside infrastructure that needs to be built and maintained, is a small fraction for the deepening of the channel. Jacksonville is very well positioned, as one of the speakers said, as far as logistics go, to distribute this. And if the federal government was going to invest their money, they'd be much better off investing it in Jacksonville than other ports where the landside infrastructure is not sufficient.
Thanks, Eric. What about that argument? David?
Well, I mean, to that point, you know, also you have to think the big question in this whole thing is, how is the city, how much money is this going to cost the city? And I think that's going to be one of the biggest factors in this. You know, what was the buzzword for pension, right? A dedicated funding source. How is the city long-term going to decide how to fund this and also fund what other projects are going on? Shipyards, district, all of the other priorities now that pension's resolved.
Well, this is bigger than Jacksonville. And so the involvement from the federal government and matching dollars from the state. So what's good for Jacksonville in this case is really good for other parts of the state. The caller brings up an excellent point where if Jacksonville is going to be competitive in the long term with our port, we're going to have to figure out a way to work with environmentalists and be as competitive on that side in terms of mitigation and figure out the best practices and best ways to do that. Maybe down the road they account for more money for mitigation and more environmental concerns when they figure out when they come to agreement on what those concerns may be, what the biggest concerns may be.
Yeah, I mean, this just seems like a lot of battling to handle Asian import goods. I seem to remember a guy running for president last year saying we needed to build things in America again. but this is going to be an import port. I mean, what are we really exporting out of it? So it's all bringing in goods, from offshore production, and it's basically a socialized cost, and it's going to be privatized profit. The people working at the port are going to do fine, and the people who actually own, like, the companies associated with it are going to do really fine. But for the rest of us, we're paying for something that doesn't have, tangible direct benefit to us.
Here's an email about that from Rob. I have concerns on not only how this will impact the environment and the blasting being used to deepen the river, but also how will the Trump administration's attempt to restrict trade with other nations impact these jobs and the local economy? So they're talking about deepening the port. The same people that supported President Trump, let's be clear, are talking about how important it is to deepen the port so that more cheap goods can come in, mainly from China, at the same time that the president is saying that is the ruination of this country. Cognitive dissonance much?
Not from our president, no.
I mean, seriously, what about that?
It's definitely a mixed signal, right?
Yeah, it's a fascinating dynamic. It goes back to the campaign, and as he was talking about, as AG pointed out over and over again, we need to stop. We need to make things here, and basically, in essence, the port dynamics is more imports, and we need these coming to Jacksonville from overseas. So,
well, we're always going to have imports, so
sure.
It makes sense still to be able to prepare to use that as an industry and to take advantage of that as commerce. So perhaps they've got a brighter idea of doing more exports. So export, but we still have to be able to take advantage of this as a commerce. And so,
what was our economic growth rate last year or this last quarter? 0.7%. I mean, the economy is slowing down. That's a reality, and if the economic trend holds, we're going to see a few bad years coming out from D.C. just with the macro economy. Rick Scott's talking about how job growth is slowing down on state level. So, we're headed toward what looks like a recession. I mean, the stock market is, bumped up right now, but a lot of that is quantitative easing. And when Fed policy changes, all of this is going to change also.
All right, let's go to Jim on the west side. Hi, Jim. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thank you. I just wanted to point out that really it's a travesty to heap any more abuse onto our St. John's River or to any wild natural assets in Florida. We can always turn any beautiful place into industry. A port has so much potential. Well, you know what? Cumberland Island has a lot of development potential too. Why don't we develop Cumberland Island? Why don't we put a port on Cumberland Island? That would be very competitive. When we talk about importing goods from Asia, well, where is the horrendous pollution? The horrendous pollution is in China. So we can always trade our natural beauty for competitiveness and economic gain. But what is Florida? What is Jacksonville? We should always put environmental concerns first. And I'm certain that we won't, but it's going to be a shame. And I appreciate the comments that I've heard from the panel. Mark Woods, I appreciate your columns. And I appreciate the gentleman who talked about the socialized cost but the privatized gain. That's what we're really looking at. And thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Jim. Here's a tweet from Ryan. Two things to remember about this. The federal money is about half of the $40 million needed for the first phase. And the distribution centers will be built in Georgia, not Jacksonville. A lot of wrinkles to this.
Valid concerns, especially on the environmental side. Those issues have to be worked out as we go along. But just know, this project is going forward. I mean, from all with the funding, it's going to go forward. So it looks like all parties pretty much at this point need to come together and figure out how to do it and be satisfied with potential outcomes on it.
All right, let's talk about some other headlines from the week. The number to join us, 549-2937. Also making headlines this week, just as Jaxport is getting some cash, Florida State College at Jacksonville, or FSCJ, is bracing for a major cut to its operating budget. Lawmakers say they cut $30 million from the state college system this legislative session, partly because fewer students are enrolling in remedial classes. FSCJ expects to lose about $3 million. President Cynthia Bioto says the cut would result in laying off more than 70 staffers. And the other day on this program, she called out Northeast Florida senators by name and said that they should be doing more to help. Senator Audrey Gibson responded back to WJCT and said if it weren't for her advocacy in Tallahassee and others, the cuts would have been even worse. So lots of concern around town about these potential cuts to our local community slash state college, FSCJ.
Right. And they, you know, I think their argument is that they've, you know, they haven't increased tuition in something like 5 years, and their goal is affordable education, and that they educate about, I think it's tens of thousands, maybe 50,000 people annually. And, you know, this is a vital piece of the state and our local educational system. And, you know, we talk about jobs, jobs, jobs. Well, guess what? That starts with education, education, education. And so, yes, it is a disappointing spot to see cuts being made.
Yeah, I mean, the argument the president, Bioto, made on this program the other day is it's the only option to get an associate's degree or a four-year degree at really low to no cost for many students, and enables them then to go on to a middle-class job, paying a middle-class wage. And so she's lobbying people who support FSCJ to besiege the governor and is hoping he vetoes this budget. But whether that is a possibility is, you know, I don't think likely. AG, David?
Yeah. If you look at this, we're seeing a shift in governmental policy from the Rick Scott-like era, which, you know, was incentives basically to keep things like status quo a little bit more on funding, you know, to the Richard Corcoran sort of House conservative era, which is if it can't be demonstrated as having a direct, tangible benefit, then, you know, it's got to be looked at for cuts. And if you look at FSCJ's graduation rate, last one that's up on Google is 2014, 35.1%. That's one in every three, give or take, you know, who is getting that middle class lifestyle out of the education. So, you know, maybe there should be a proposal of a new model or, you know, changing the calculation for graduation rates or, you know, whatever. But just to cry, oh, these cuts are happening. Yeah, I mean, these cuts are happening. More cuts are going to happen because, as I said 5 minutes ago, the state economy is slowing down. We're going to move into an era of austerity. I mean, we saw a boom over 5-6 years that was driven by a lot of global macroeconomic policy. And the brakes are on that now. And the cuts are happening, and they're going to be real, and they're going to happen again.
Dave.
Some people may be arguing that the more students enrolling in the state university system under the state colleges on the FSCJ level, because they get a better cost per dollar, you know, so it's cheaper to go there. So, and they're getting the same. We heard a story recently about the FSCJ graduates from FSCJ getting higher paying jobs than graduates from UNF. So there may be some leveling of the playing field at play here, so that we can get some more. You know, to kind of pull back on the FSCJs of the state of Florida and make sure that they are not soaking up all of the potential good students or the students that are out there. And I've heard that sort of in the background of a little bit of what been going on with the actual dollars funding.
You know, on the flip side of this, you know, they're going to say, well, let's look at FSCJ's operating budget, $145 million. Does $3 million really impact it that much? You know, maybe there would be more concern if this were $10, $20 million in cuts. I went to FSCJ, full disclosure here, so I do know how important these staff positions are to these campuses, but, you know, that's going to be the argument as well, is we're not completely shutting this down, but we're making incremental cuts as we go.
Well, the funding that they were talking about, and if I heard the president correctly, that's pretty much the lifeblood of the student activity. They're tutors and folks who they provide support services to the students there who need more remediation. So, and that's what, of course, FSCJ has been known to do, is bring students up through from the lowest levels through graduation. And that may explain some of the graduation rates as well.
Well, if you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we talk about the biggest stories of the week. The number to join the show, 549-2937. And drama this week on the Jacksonville City Council as Anna Brochet beat John Cressenbeny for the council presidency. Some Democrats on the council threw their votes to Brochet, the Republican, rather than their fellow Democrat Cressenbeny. Now, Brochet broke ground as the first female and Filipino-American city council member in Florida when she was first elected. This marks a new milestone for the council as well. A.G. Gankarski, there was a lot going on behind the scenes about this, correct?
Yes, but the narrative boils down to Brochet won by 3 points, and she got, or 3 votes, and she got 4 African-American Democrats, Katrina Brown, Reggie Brown, Garrett Dennis, and, you know, and that basically was it. Reggie Gaffney. They all basically went with her in the end. I can tell you why that happened also. John Cressenbeny did not build relationships with them. I had one tell me that he didn't even talk to me or look at me when he passes me in the hall. You know, Cressenbeny's got a rep for knowing the most on council and letting you know he knows most on council. And that didn't sit well. Anna Brochet basically comes at it with a conciliatory, a sort of let's all work together and find a solution that works attitude. And ultimately, the choice was between collaboration and autocracy. And they went with collaboration.
You think they would have seen him as an autocratic president?
Yes. I mean, if you go back to the 2016 vice presidential race, a lot of the narrative was Cressenbeny allegedly dropped a dime to the Florida Times Union about people texting with the fire union chief on budget night over some money being moved to the fire budget from stormwater. That never went away, and Cressenbeny said it didn't happen, but they didn't believe him. And, you know, if you've got a credibility gap in your own party and your major supporters are white male Republicans, it raises questions, it raises red flags. A lot of people outside of that building misunderstand this council presidency race. They're like, oh, John Cressenbeny is a good public servant. It's more than that. It's about playing well in the sandbox with others, and Democrats did not believe Cressenbeny would do that.
Charles.
I haven't seen this much drama in a council president race since Warren Jones was elected back in 92. So one of the things that is obvious is that when you are campaigning for council presidency or trying to ascend to that office, that seat, the politics is intense, and you have to make promises and you have to make commitments to those people you want support from. And the biggest chip on the table in all these cases would be chairmanships. And so if you can successfully sort of maneuver that process and make some promises that, you know, promise some things to some people and not overpromise to others, you can move people, chips over to your side. And I think that's what happened here. It looks like that's what happened here.
Mark Woods.
One of the things that struck me is, you know, we come off Lori Boyer, city council president, and we go to Anna Brochet.
2 women in a row.
Right. And how I was thinking back, I think it was 2013, they had that 9 in 15 campaign, because
that's still going on, by the way. I think they might, maybe they'll change the name.
Yeah.
But yeah. To get more women elected to office.
Right. Because at that point, I think we had in 2013, 3 women on the city council, and they talked about how once upon a time it had been 10 of 19. So since then, obviously, there has been a shift, a dramatic change. You have back to back, you have, you know, you had Audrey Moran run for mayor, and I wonder, I think it's at some point in the near future we could have a woman as mayor of Jacksonville.
David Cotton.
Melissa Ross.
No. you tell good jokes, Mark. David Cotton.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the big concerns, of course, coming outside of that building was, you know, Anna Brochet is not experienced enough. She hasn't been on the council long enough, and that John Cressenbeny obviously has. You know, she told me that that was, you know, a convenient narrative, really, to put out there. And I think she's tried to squash that as much as possible.
Collegiality goes a long way, then, is what it sounds as though you're saying was going on here.
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of narratives around this. And, you know, a lot of Sabrosa characterized the assassination of Broche. I mean, let's be clear about it. You know, Broche got hit hard out of the gate, even before a first pledge meeting. Gollifer was saying, well, I won't serve on a standing committee in the Broche administration. Well, Gollifer's walking that one back. And, you know, a lot of this kind of mansplaining sort of attitude among President May's supporters.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, there was just...
I've never heard of this mansplaining. Tell me how it works.
It was waist thick in that room. And that's really the thing. I mean, Broche's got plenty of experience. She ran finance committee last year. You know, she made the jump from that to council president race, but, you know, Crescent Bay was vulnerable. I mean, Crescent Bay would not have won Veep last year if Reggie Gaffney hadn't flipped his vote at the last moment. And so it was a tenuous hold. It deserved to be a contested election, and it was contested.
It is fascinating, though, that someone who's fairly new to the council, new to the last race, was able to politically maneuver beyond a veteran like John Crescent Benny. And I think that speaks a lot to what this tenure may look like, this particular one-year tenure of council president.
And correct me if I'm wrong, we've had African-American council presidents, we've had female council presidents, but have we ever before had a female, a female person of color? This is a big change for Jacksonville.
It is a big change, and it also proves the point that all politics is local, because you could pretty much remove those R's and D's from this process. I mean, I don't think it had anything to do with it. It was about, commitment. What are you going to do for me on this? What can we expect? What type of leadership we can expect from that particular person? And again, it's fascinating to me that someone fresh out of the box was able to, outmaneuver a veteran like that.
All right. Well, in pure numbers, one other news and note from the week. The city of Jacksonville and the city of Miami were among the nation's leaders in population gains over the last year. The Census Bureau says Jacksonville increased by 13,500 people, a little bit more than Miami's increase. So Council President Broche will be presiding over a growing city. One other note, lots of activity downtown this weekend, everything from the Jazz Festival to the opening of Daly's Place with Tedeschi Trucks. To political talk on the corner from A.G. Gankarski drawing thousands. I heard that was happening, too.
I've got a bullhorn, a soapbox, and some poster board.
Sandbox that you referenced earlier.
Yeah, I've heard that is a growing concern. So if you're coming into the city, check jackssheriff.org for all those road closures, okay? And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Actually, there kind of was a shortage this week. Once.
Don't worry.
Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. Only a couple stories from the week that we found, but only in Florida do teenagers answer FaceTime calls with a stolen cell phone. Yes, 18-year-old Chandler Carlisle of Fort Walton Beach was arrested after he took the phone during a party. The victim told police he let Carlisle use the phone to call for a ride home. He then left with the $600 device and made a FaceTime call on it, which police were able to quickly screenshot, thus arresting the teen. Only in Florida does the legacy of the epic film Titanic go on and on and on with a lawsuit. Yes, Stephen Cummings of Titusville wants $300 million from Titanic director James Cameron. He claims his life in the yachting industry inspired the Oscar-winning director to write the epic drama.
Of course.
Sounds legit.
Cummings' lawsuit claims that the Leonardo DiCaprio character of Jack Dawson is based solely on him. He is also suing Lightstorm Entertainment, Sony Pictures Classics, Paramount, and 20th Century Fox, saying Cameron was inspired to write the script based on his life story in the yachting industry, along with his family history and distant relatives who were actually aboard the vessel Titanic when it sank in 1912.
Just cut the check. I mean, right? I'm convinced.
Cameron's version of the story, of course, went on to win a record-tying 11 Oscars, including Best Picture of 1997. All right, it's not a week if a crazy lawsuit isn't filed in Florida. And it's not a Friday if you guys aren't here to make us all smile going into the weekend. And hope you have a great weekend. Enjoy it. And thanks for being with us. Charles Griggs, David Cotton, A.G. Gienkarski, and Mark Woods. Happy Memorial Day, you guys.
Thank you very much.
You too.
And we'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Goodwill of North Florida. Donate, shop, jobs. Good things for North Florida with Goodwill. Proud supporters of WJCT's First Coast Connect. GoodwillJax.org for more info.
Next time on 1A, it's the Friday News Roundup. In Washington, both sides balk at the budget. Abroad, the Brits stand up to terror.
The spirit of Manchester and the spirit of Britain is far mightier than the sick plots of depraved terrorists.
The Friday News Roundup, that's next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Join us to honor and remember our troops, our veterans, our military families.
A tribute to our American heroes, the National Memorial Day Concert.
Join me, Joe Mantegna.
And me, Lawrence Fishburne.
With Gary Sinise.
General Colin Powell.
Renee Fleming.
Scotty McCreary.
Auli'i Cruvalio.
Christopher Jackson.
John Ortiz. And the National Symphony Orchestra.
Join us for a night to remember.
The National Memorial Day Concert.
Sunday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
Welcome back. Well, according to a recent study, Duval County Public Schools 8th graders from low-income communities are half as likely to be proficient in reading and math as their more affluent peers. That's not a surprise when you consider that 61% of low-income families have no books in their homes for kids to read. Ellen Wiss is founder of Read USA, a nonprofit here in Jacksonville, and she's working to change those statistics by bringing back the book fair to more local schools. It's a way to get a book to every student and classroom. Ellen Wiss joins us along with Karen Sawyer, rep with Scholastic. Ladies, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Ellen, let's begin with you. At my younger daughter's elementary school, Chet's Creek Elementary, there is an annual book fair, but that is a privilege. Unfortunately, that's not something that's happening at every school in the area. You want to change that, right?
That's right. So you remember the book fairs, right? When you were in school, you show up, you expect it's exciting, and they're there, and you don't think about the fact that there's a PTA that's organizing and putting this on for you, and there's resources that are brought to the school, and that your mom gives you money to go buy books. You don't think about that. You think that's something that is common.
Right.
And but in low-income schools, can you not hear me?
No, you're good. It's not going to happen without extra help.
That's right.
Exactly.
The parents care. They would love to organize and bring resources like PTA, as a PTA, but they're, the resources aren't there. So we started, and I did this by, I was in the classroom of this amazing teacher a few years ago, and she just had command of her classroom. She had all of her kids wanting to perform for her, and she was amazing. She had the greatest gains in all of the district, and I said, I just wanted to, multiply her impact. I said, what I can't do what you do, but what can I do?
Yeah.
She said, this school has never had a book fair. It was shocking to me. So I said, well, why? Well, think about it. And then all of the things we just talked about. So I said, well, if you can organize internally with the staff and the principal, I'll help you get funding, and we'll make sure every child gets to go through a book fair. So we started that model 6 years ago. And then, you know, I'm involved with several education groups, and I started inviting education folks to these book fairs. It's just the most wonderful volunteer experience. There's not anyone that touches it that doesn't leave saying, this is fabulous. You know, how can I help more? So it's wonderful. So I started inviting people and you know, from Jacksonville Public Education Fund, Teach for America, and by the way, the co-founder with me, this teacher, is a TFA alum. City or others came, and they're like, oh my gosh, little Pam Paul with Jacksonville Public Education Fund.
Little Pam Paul. You mean the younger Pam Paul,
the
yes.
The younger Pam
yes,
Paul,
yes.
Who's
how funny.
A legend in her own time,
yes.
Too, said... you know, Ellen, this is not that much money. This is really scalable to have this much impact on a school. Have you thought about going into other schools? And so she put the seed in my head. And of course, with that, I felt the responsibility and, the desire to grow.
And you did.
And we did. And of course, with others' help, Nina Waters talked to Dolores Weaver, and Dolores said, I like it. If they can do it, if they can do four more schools this summer, or before this summer, I'm in, I'll sponsor them. And so we were in the school, we were in Carver, in our fourth year, and with that challenge, we had less than a month before we had the book fairs going on. But and I said, of course we will. And but to do that, how are we going to do that? So I met with Dan Foley, the CEO or the head of City Year, and said, can you help me? We need to get. We're expanding 500% into this book fair model. I don't want to not, you know, follow through with Miss Weaver's offer here. And so he called me back in less than 24 hours and said, we'll commit two city or core members to every single shift, every single school, every single day of the fair.
Nice.
Done. And we were able to expand 500% in that, you know, right before the summer of that year, and off and running.
Okay, and so what you, in the founding of Read USA, what you did that's so brilliant is you partnered with Scholastic. Most parents know about Scholastic. Yeah. They get offered those books all over the country. Karen Sawyer, how is Scholastic then making sure that each child can purchase their favorite books at the book fairs where Ellen is setting up around town this week?
Well, the most important thing is that the children have a chance to choose the book that they want. Because when they choose the book themselves, instead of somebody just handing them a book, they're going to read it, they're going to love it, and they're going to want to have more opportunities. So with the Scholastic Book Fair, it is just that moving bookstore. The metal cases are rolled in, Clifford delivers the book fair, and there's a large assortment of books. So every child is able to go through the book fair, find a book that they're excited about, that they want to take home and read over the summer. So we just make sure that all of the books continue to stay stocked throughout the week. And we bring them the latest and the greatest titles and the latest and the greatest genres. Graphic novels continue to get more and more popular. And we have some amazing authors that we make sure that we partner with, and we provide those books. Dive a Wimpy Kid, how many years has that been popular? And every year he comes out with a new book, and Scholastic's able to provide it in a less expensive version as a paperback instead of hardcover everywhere else. So by doing that, these kids are able to find those books and be able to bring more books home.
And kids are getting a $15 voucher at lower income schools to purchase a book too. Isn't that right?
Yes.
That's correct. Yeah. That's what the donors. So all of the donations that are collected go directly 100% to purchase books. So for the books in the kids of hand, I mean, in the hands of kids.
And even better.
But even better, Scholastic matches 55% of every dollar with scholastic dollars, which is the same as a regular dollar, but we put that back into the schools, into the classroom, so the teachers get to beef up their classroom libraries because they have a better sense of what the kids are going to be interested
in. And you've done this year at 6 local elementary schools,
right,
all this week.
Mm-hmm.
Susie Tolbert.
It's been fun.
Brentwood, S.P. Livingston.
2,500 kids.
Wow. Annie Morgan, G.W. Carver, and Rufus Payne Elementary.
That's right.
What's it been like at these schools to see these kids' faces with the book fair?
It's sending us off with the best.
Heartwarming.
We are going to have the best weekend. I mean, we have the imprints of these children in our brains, and it's the best. It's really the best, experience.
And at these 6 schools, was this the first time they'd had this type of book fair?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So when you came in with the books and the kids flooded in and were going through, what was that like?
Just pure joy.
It is. You have to come.
Pure joy. They are so excited to see the books and to have that opportunity to know that they get to take it home because they don't know what that's like.
And they get, it's the choosing of the book that's the key. I know that you mentioned the graphic novels. When book fair was held at my daughter's school this year, my younger one's school, Chet's Creek Elementary, she was very excited, and she chose a graphic novel called Ghosts that's really popular right now.
Raina Talgemeier is a wonderful author.
Yeah, and she has read it over and over and over because she picked it out, and she got to buy it. I gave her a little money to buy a book, and she got to buy the book and take it home. It's that feeling of ownership, I think, that drives the and it embeds that love of reading in the children.
Absolutely.
It's so exciting. So then, Ellen, are you planning to do this again next year?
Absolutely.
What's next year going to look like?
We want to be in more schools. Yep.
So you need help to do that, too, don't you? Do you want to call out to the community?
Absolutely. We would love to have you as volunteers. You're going to have the best volunteer experience. We would love to have you help as funders. It's, again, your donations 100% go towards books in the hands of kids. So it's a win-win for everyone. It's a game changer if kids learn to read, or if they love to read, they can do anything.
And how can they get in touch with Read USA?
So we have a website, www.readusainc.com. My contact information, email me, eawiss@aol.com. could I share a couple of notes from, we get thank you notes. Oh, we are crying with thank you notes. It's just, you get them and it's just so heartwarming. But do you mind if I read?
Sure.
Okay. So here's one. The book fair and reading celebration mean that we can learn over the summer. The book fair mean we can learn and read more over the summer. When you go to the book fair, you can keep your head in those books instead of killing other people for no reason.
Wow.
When you have the book fair, you can inspire people to do something amazing and something to make this world a better place. Having a reading celebration would be good because you can have the kids who read be noticed and celebrated for just reading. Even though to some people it's just reading, to me, every second of reading counts. That's one of them. We have thousands.
You have many more.
Thousands.
But that gives you an idea of the good you've done with this, just this week alone, and much more to come. What a great way for the kids to get into their summer. Well, Ellen Wiss, the founder of Read USA, and Karen Sawyer with Scholastic, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
Thanks. You too.
In a moment, Tom Shedd of the Florida Folk Festival.
on The Next Fresh Air, comic, writer, and director Neil Brennan. He co-created and co-wrote the sketch comedy series Chappelle Show and co-wrote a sketch for the night Dave Chappelle hosted Saturday Night Live just after Donald Trump was elected. Brennan has a Netflix comedy special that includes personal stories about depression, his family, and comedy. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross.
Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Hi, this is Chris Thiele inviting you to join us this weekend for a Prairie Home Companion from the Fitzgerald Theater in downtown St. Paul. With the multi-talented Ben Folds, Brandi Carlile, and the incredibly funny actor-comedian Ed Helms, plus the Punch Brothers were in the house, along with Sarah Jaros. Also, the song of the week was about the Mississippi River, which was frozen at the time. All this and more. Hope you'll join us.
Saturday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
It's a jazz festival week, so the Electro Lounge is playing jazz Tuesday through Saturday night at 9 p.m. on WJCT 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Some people look for love in the dark, some people look in the bright light of day. Some people howl at the moon in the park. Some drop to the knees and pray. Oh, me, I don't know much about love.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, the 65th annual Florida Folk Festival is set for this weekend in White Springs. It's a celebration of the music, art, and people that make Florida unique. Festival spokesman Tom Shedd, who has performed at this event for an incredible 45 years, joins us now. That's what your website says. Good morning, Tom Shedd.
I'll get that fixed right away.
Is that not right?
It is, but I try not to wear that too. Now, I was a wee youngin'. I was just a small embryo with boots.
That's right. You were 2 years old the first year.
I'll let you know. But it's a wonderful place. It's a beautiful day in Florida. It's a beautiful weekend. And what a great thing to take your family out to your Florida Folk Festival right out there in White Springs, where I-10 and I-75 get together for 65 years, 10 stages, all the music in the world, all the food, the arts, the craft, everything has something to do with Florida.
I am amazed that you have built this legacy with the festival. 45 years of incredible performances from you, Tom Shedd, the face of this event. But there will be hundreds of musicians on 10 stages.
Absolutely. And that's what we do. It's unlike most festivals where there's a commercial aspect to it. The state of Florida and the Florida State Park System is putting this on for the people of Florida. With 10 performing areas, you're spread out. It's a gold medal award-winning 850-acre park on the banks of the Suwannee. And there's small stages, medium stages, larger stages. If you want a custom seat, bring a chair and a bag, you know.
Absolutely.
And there's an app. You can download a free app. It'll show you where everybody is. And there's programs there, and it's color-coded to show you what kind of music. So you can listen to music you like, or you can listen to music you never heard of, because we've got music from Cuba, Puerto Rico, Haiti, from the Pensacola to Miami.
Not only that, this is amazing. Visitors this year can wrestle with alligators. They can participate in a Mayan water blessing in the Suwannee River. Kids can visit a snow cone station powered by a human hamster wheel. You guys have dreamed up all kinds of stuff here.
That's right, because you know, when you do something long enough, you find out various ways to share the joy and wonder it is to live in the Sunshine State.
Now, we are so excited. A special treat is you, Tom Shedd, this incredible folk singer. You will be headlining, of course, at the festival. You've got a song for us. What are you going to play?
Oh, that's good. What was I going to play? I'll play a song written by a man that mentored me, that took me from a guitar, rock and roll guitar player in Jacksonville, to being an acoustic musician writing songs about something, and his name was Don Grooms.
Mm-hmm.
Don Grooms grew up in the mountains of Cherokee, North Carolina. His mom raised five kids on an income of $12.50 a month. Brother's clothes got down to him. She'd wash them, patch them, say, "They're not much, son, but we didn't steal them and nobody give them to us, so you wear them and you walk proud. Use it up, wear it out. Make it do or do without. We can't pay for things you want to buy. Wear your old faded jeans. They are patched, but they are clean. Walk proud, my son, and hold your head up high." I grew up way back in the hills with the bears and whippoorwills. Closest store, 35 miles away. Although I'm now full-grown man, when I close my eyes I can hear the words my mother used to say. Use it up, wear it out, make it do or do without. We can't pay for things you wanna buy. Wear your old faded jeans. They're patched but they are clean. Walk proud, my son, and hold your head up high. Now I've got a son of my own. Even got his own telephone. Seems like I buy him something every day. Got everything money can buy. And it makes me want to cry, 'cause I know he'll never hear his mother say, "Use it up, wear it out. Make it do or do without. We can't pay for things you wanna buy. Wear your old faded jeans. They're patched, but they are clean. Walk proud, my son, hold your head up high. Walk proud, my son, and hold your head up high."
Yay! Thank you. My goodness. That was beautiful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And come on out to your Florida Folk Festival.
That's right. It is Friday through Sunday at the Stephen Foster Culture Center State Park in White Springs. Get on out and enjoy this beautiful weekend and look for some video of Tom Shebb performing on our WJCT Facebook page. Tom Shebb, you are a Florida treasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so very much.
I'm Melissa Ross, and we'll be back later next week. We'll be off Monday and Tuesday. But enjoy your Memorial Day holiday. Have a beautiful, safe, and happy weekend. We'll see you soon.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.